Thank you, Your Honor. Please the court, Trent Reinberger here on behalf of Don Foods, and it's insurer, attorney number 36468. And I will probably reserve some time for rebuttal. We are here today on an issue of the admissibility of scientific evidence. This case arises out of a workers' compensation hearing in which the ALJ ultimately determined that the claimant was permanently and totally disabled. Specifically, the issue is whether an analysis regarding the reliability of purportedly scientific evidence is required prior to its admission and consideration by the finder of fact. Schreck and subsequent cases requires the judge, in this case the administrative law judge with the Office of Administrative Courts, to perform a preliminary analysis for evidence purporting to be scientific. The judge must analyze whether that evidence is based on reliable scientific principles and whether the expert is qualified to testify to that scientific evidence. In this case, the ALJ declined to do an analysis. The ALJ overruled respondents' Schreck challenge by ruling that the evidence was per se non-scientific evidence.
Counsel, before you go further, why wasn't this evidence admissible under 843.210, which the panel found it was? And if it's admissible under that statute, does the Schreck standard still apply? Does this court still have to go through that analysis if the statute allows the admissibility without any further foundation?
Thank you, Your Honor. I think the Industrial Claims Appeals Office order is unclear, and the reasoning is somewhat unclear, but I think that is an interpretation of their order, and it's an interpretation that that I disagree with and find quite worrisome. It does appear that the Court of Appeals, Claims Appeals Office, they did not specifically address whether or not the evidence was or was not categorically scientific. They seem to suggest that, well, even if it is, because the document is a vocational evaluation, that they say it's a vocational evaluation, and clearly the judge disagreed with that. The ALJ stated that it was not a vocational evaluation and declined to admit it without identification as a vocational evaluation. But yes, the Claims Appeals Office seems to suggest that, well, if it's a vocational report, then it comes in. But if you look at the statute, 843.210, it doesn't say that. It doesn't say anything about admissibility for any, or challenges to admissibility for any other reason other than formal identification. The statute says you can admit it without formal identification.
What do you think that term means?
I think it means exactly the way it plays out in the workers' compensation system. These are claimants that are usually in treatment with various medical providers. We have these hearings. We have the medical records. They have medical records. We have the medical records. And they were able to submit those without bringing the doctors in to identify the records or to testify to the opinions that are contained within those medical records. So it's a rule that allows specific kinds of records to come in without identification. So that's a foundation issue. It's a authentication issue. It's not an issue that determines that Schreck doesn't apply to workers' compensation. And in fact, there's case law already stating that the rules of Schreck and that analysis applies to workers' compensation. And if any of the records that fall under 843.210 don't require such an analysis, then Schreck really doesn't apply, because it's hard to imagine what records would be submitted in a workers' compensation hearing that aren't medical records, that would be scientific, that aren't medical records, that aren't under that category.
You feel you could have raised the same objection to a medical record, to a report of a doctor?
Absolutely. And I think that's part of why this is an important appeal, because if a medical record came in from a doctor, it's a medical record, but the doctor's medical report talks about a device of his own creation, which is a painometer that he's developed, that he says this measures subjective reports of pain. And I've read my painometer, and I've determined that these subjective reports of pain are valid. Well,
that would clearly be subject to a Shrek analysis. There is no such thing as a painometer. It's not a scientifically recognized device. But if the Court of Appeals argument and finding an opinion was carried to its logical conclusion, we would be precluded from challenging that. It would just go to weight. It wouldn't go to admissibility at all. It's a medical record.
You had the opportunity to cross-examine the vocational therapist, did you not?
Yes.
Right. In Shrek, they say under 702 initially, there's when something is omitted, they think the safety of that omission is the fact of vigorous cross-examination.
Well, I think that there's a preliminary issue as to whether or not the evidence is admissible. In this particular case, the evidence came in as in a report prepared by somebody else other than the person test.
A supervisor. It was,
ostensibly a supervisee relationship. Right. Somebody who works for her company does the actual performance of the tests. And then she comes and testifies, she being Ms. Shriver. But there still was no analysis of the reliability of the underlying tests. There was no analysis by the ALJ. And his stated ruling was that he doesn't have to perform one. It's not sufficient to say that, well, we can presume that because the ALJ ultimately relied on opinions that were based on the test, that the ALJ therefore determined that the tests were themselves reliable. There's no findings of that. And the ALJ stated that, hey, it's not scientific, I don't have to do it. So, and it also is my understanding of the Shrek requirement that it has to be a preliminary determination. And I think that that's important because if you look at the practicalities of trying the case, it's important that the parties know at the outset what is and what is not in evidence. In other words, if the court says, well, I'm not going to make a determination as to whether or not the underlying facts are reliable or not, and therefore I'm not going to make a determination as to whether or not the testing is, or testimony based upon that testing is admissible. I'm just going to wait and determine that later after the hearing is concluded. Well, the parties are certainly at a disadvantage at that point. For example, what evidence would one put on? If one puts on evidence to rebut the evidence that may or may not be admissible, has one then opened the door to its admissibility? You put on counter evidence to the claims that are being made. Have you thereby made it admissible?
Well, ask you a question. You did not object to the Ms. Shriver testifying as an expert, as I understand the assertion made in the appellee's brief. Is that correct?
It is correct. She was offered as an expert in three areas, I believe: occupational therapy, vocational evaluation, and life planning, I believe.
And then when she was asked questions, did you object to the opinions that were solicited by those questions, or are you just objecting to the report itself that when it was offered?
We objected to the report and to the testimony based upon the report, and the ALJ's ruling was that the report, in overruling that objection, was that the report is not scientific and that she would be allowed to testify to the report and to her opinions based upon the report.
And the opinions that she gave were opinions about the ability of the claimant to perform certain kinds of work. Isn't that right? More or less, is that what she testified to? Or lack of ability to perform certain kinds of work?
I think it's fair characterization.
And that was based on certain tests that were done by the person you call her a supervisee, I guess, right?
Correct.
And is your position that the tests that were performed by the supervisee were not shown to be reliable?
That's correct.
Doesn't the report itself contain evidence of reliability of those tests? It contains certain references to academic literature that show that the tests are reliable. Couldn't the ALJ rely on those?
There are some statements about it. There are some references to articles and, you know, and they have the names of the different tests they do. But there isn't an explanation as to what the tests are, who developed them. Have they been proven to be reliable? Is there literature to support that they're reliable? Has their reliability been tested? I don't think that there's substantial evidence in the record for the ALJ to make that determination of the reliability of the underlying tests within that report. And moreover, there's certainly no evidence that the ALJ ever did that.
So did you did receive this report prior to the hearing?
Yes.
Objection prior to the hearing? If you can raise that objection in the hearing, the person offering it really is not in a position to present the evidence that you say they need to present. They haven't been on notice that such an objection is going to be raised, isn't that?
Well, I think the particularly under the workers' compensation system and where the, and how these hearings are handled, there's not a lot of opportunity to necessarily do that prior to the hearing. Generally speaking, these reports have to be exchanged, I think, 20 days prior to hearing. And so there's a very short period of time of whether or not you would be able to get any sort of preliminary hearing on the issue of admissibility prior to the actual hearing itself. But certainly at these hearings, you know, they can be carried over if need be. If they need to have a preliminary hearing on admissibility and say, you know, your first hearing, you decide with the admissibility of evidence issues, and then you, if you can't finish that day, then you carry it over to a separate date. I suppose in the ideal world, then yes, what you would have is an opportunity to have a preliminary determination as to the admissibility of evidence, what is and what is not going to be admitted. But in the practicalities of the workers' compensation system, these hearings move pretty quickly.
Another question. You did not object to the expertise in the field offered for this witness. Given that there was no objection, you knew she was going to offer these opinions. Why did you stipulate to her expertise? Because if her opinions are based upon these inadmissible tests, then why would you stipulate to her expertise and allow her to offer an opinion?
Well, I think those are two separate issues. I mean, the question as to whether or not she has expertise in vocational evaluations, or whether she has some expertise in occupational therapy. She herself testified this was not occupational therapy. She testified that this report, whatever you want to call it, the workers' compensation evaluation is not occupational therapy. I would contend it's not a vocational report either, and the judge found that as well. The judge found this is not a vocational report. So the experts' qualifications to testify on particular matters, I think, is a separate issue, maybe related to, but it's a separate question than whether or not what they are particularly testifying to meets the Schreck standard. In other words, a doctor could be admitted as an expert in medicine, but again, if he started testifying to a painometer, the Schreck challenges raises its head.
Isn't this the standard kind of thing that is ALJs see all the time, these kinds of evaluations of people's ability to perform work? They see them all the time, don't they?
I don't think this particular workers' compensation evaluation, I would not characterize it as typical.
Particular tests that it was describing, they see results from all the time, don't they?
I don't think so.
Okay. Before you use up your time, I want to ask about the second issue you raised in your brief. You argue that causation was not found by the ALJ, and I'm a little confused by that because it seems to me he adopted the prior order by administrative law judge, I think it's Kanisi, from May 12th, and that has a finding, does it not, that it satisfies the causation requirement?
Yes, Your Honor. This will be a difficult question to delve into in the limited time that I have, but there is a distinction in workers' compensation between compensability and causation, and they're two separate questions. The issue of compensability, which was tried and determined at that prior hearing by ALJ Kanichi, determines whether or not the claimant suffered an injury. and it was found that he did suffer an injury. The question as to causation is a question as to, okay, well, what does that injury entail? What does it cause? And that remains an open question. At the time that initial hearing was held, the question that's pertinent to the permanent total disability question, which is, did the injury cause these disabilities that ultimately the ALJ relied upon to say he was permanent total disabled, obviously was not determined. We weren't at that stage of the case at that point.
It was a finding then that the injury that he suffered was a work-related injury caused by his work.
Correct.
Okay.
Compensability was determined. Again, the distinction is between compensability and causation.
So you're saying the injuries that were found by the administrative law judge in the hearing a year later weren't shown to be the same injuries that were found to be injuries that were work-related for purposes of compensability?
The restrictions and limitations that the ALJ relied upon to determine that the claimant was permanently or totally disabled, there was no causation established between the initial injury, which was a minor back strain, and the subsequent complaints. The medical evidence is that there isn't a connection. The medical evidence by the treating physician, Dr. Brock, says that I can't make a connection between the two. The guy had previous back problems, previous back complaints. He's got these subjective complaints now. He did have an the back strain that required some treatment, but I can't make a causal connection between that and any work restrictions he has now. So the treating physician said he doesn't have any work restrictions related to the work injury. So that's the medical evidence. And the question is there any findings that from the ALJ to connect the injury with the ultimate determinations that, well, he's got these disabilities that I'm going to use to say that the guy can never work again.
Well, you're out of time, but when the ALJ says in paragraph 5 of his conclusions that the claimant is permanently and totally disabled because of the low back industrial injury he suffered in the course of scope of his employment with the employer November 4th, 2009, why doesn't that satisfy the causation requirement that you say he, with respect to which you claim he made no finding?
Because there aren't any findings to support that conclusion. Respondents would contend that's just the conclusion. Okay, he had an injury, he's disabled. I find that he's probably totally disabled as a result of the injury. The question is are there any findings of fact on the causation issue to connect one to the other? Thank you.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. I'm Rebecca Bradley, registry number 2344, and I represent Mr. Anthony Johnson, the claimant in the workers' comp case and the appellee here, one of the appellees here. You've already touched on quite a bit, so I probably don't have 11 or 15 minutes of speech. I'll try to make it short, and I kind of touched on things in a chronological way, which is a little different, but because it was a permanent total disability case, the issues as to whether or not he was permanently totally disabled, which were tried at the hearing, include more than just the specific medical records and so forth. This is and always was an admitted low back injury, which occurred on November 4th of 2009 when Mr. Johnson tried to move and lift a very large fondant pan, which weighed, according to one of his co-workers who testified, nearly 200 pounds, certainly over 175 pounds. And that occurred because his co-worker, who should have helped him, had left early. Immediately, within 3 days, he was placed by the Concentra doctors on very limiting restrictions of no lifting at more than 10 pounds, no bending more than 2 times an hour, no squatting or kneeling, and no driving the company vehicle. The respondents accommodated these restrictions, which continued over a period in all until he was placed at maximum improvement of 9 months. For 9 months, he couldn't lift 10 pounds. So the accommodations were to provide him with a table and chair and let him stand or sit and move as fast or as slow as he would, putting box lids together. This he did for about 4 months until they fired him on account of a silly pretense because he ate somebody else's Pop-Tart and because he clocked out for a couple of minutes to replace it and didn't clock out when he went to replace it. He testified that he had been job seeking and ultimately never could find a job, went on unemployment, and kept a record of that, and he testified to that, and the judge found him to be credible as to his inability to find work and the good faith effort to do so.
I need to address the arguments that the appellant made.
Okay.
Start with the issue of whether the causation was adequately determined by the ALJ. My understanding is that their position is the permanent disability wasn't connected, there weren't findings connected to the original back injury for which compensability was decided.
Well, the judge specifically said, the judge friend specifically said that he found that the claimant's permanent total disability resulted from the November 4th work injury. So he did make that finding.
And what evidence in the record supported the connection? I think it's appellant's position that there wasn't evidence in this record that supported. Are you relying on the original finding of compensability from May?
That and causation was never challenged. The only issue was whether or not he was permanently totally disabled. There was never any kind of an affirmative defense that it wasn't until now, that it wasn't connected. There was the medical records show a low back injury, same low back injury being talked about all the way through and being admitted in the final admission in February of 2011, I guess it was. And they paid out voluntarily based just on the formula for, 4%, because he had more than one injury. He had a prior spine, neck, and low back injuries. So they apportioned out, I think the original, I don't remember what the numbers were, I think the original number was 13%, but they were totally focusing on the injury that he had from this injury, and they had already apportioned out by numbers the prior low back injury, which was aggravated and made worse. The judge took note of the fact that he had always worked, gone back to work after the prior injuries. This was the one time after this injury he never got back to work after they laid him off while he was on light duty, or fired him while he was on light duty. And he, in making his findings of permanent total disability, listed all of these efforts to go to work and then took into account the two experts. The respondent's expert was a vocational assessment expert, and you've all read, I'm sure, of Dora Schreiber, the occupational therapist's qualifications. And
what was the evidence that his permanent disability related to the back injury that was determined to be compensable in May of 2010? The occupational therapist certainly didn't testify to that, did she?
No, but the doctors did, and they gave him a permanent impairment rating because of his November 4th back injury.
Which doctor?
The Concentra doctor. He gave him a
block.
Block, yeah. And then the division independent medical doctor, Erasmus Moore, changed the numbers a little bit, but two doctors gave him a permanent impairment from a back injury that only related to this case.
Talk about the admission of the Shriver's report as a potential problem under Schreck?
This is not the kind of report that I've ever even heard anyone say should be subjected to a Schreck analysis. Schreck analysis would be, like opposing counsel indicated, something unique that the doctor or the expert created. This is nothing unique or unusual. Among her other qualifications, Doris Shriver is and has been an occupational therapist. She's practiced as a knowledgeable occupational therapist for decades. She's written countless reports and testified in countless administrative and district court and Social Security cases, sometimes at the request of the judges. She's in her report, she and her employee, who's another occupational therapist, trained, supervised, and under her employee and guidance, she testified that she determined what standard test that an occupational therapist would give in order to determine the vocational aptitude, the possibility of reemployment by in this case, claimant, Mr. Johnson. At that, she testified that the tests that she gave were chosen by her, in each case tailored to the age, education, background, experience of the particular individual. This was an individual that had, as he testified, basically graduated from high school because he was a good jock. He played football, and he played baseball, and he played basketball, and they kind of passed him back in those days. He was a strong, big man, and all of his whole life.
But for example, let me ask you an example.
Yes, sir.
The dynamic blind box test was administered by the experts, and they measured his lifting and carrying abilities, and I think other things as well, sitting, standing, and so forth. Was the expert ever asked about the reliability of the blind box test accurately or properly measuring those capabilities? Did she testify at all about that being a reliable measure that's used all the time in this industry, as experts typically do? If not, if she wasn't asked about it, how did the ALJ satisfy the reliability requirements of Schreck?
You know, I don't remember exactly which tests she testified to, but she testified, I believe.
This is one of the ones that's referred to in Exhibit 10. You can trust me on that.
It was certainly my intention to ask her about every test she gave and what it was and the reliability and the way it was given and the results and the meaning of the results. And my recollection is we had to, first on direct and then on cross-examination, she had to answer a question or questions about every single test that was given in the entire report. That report had been given, by the way, not 20 days, but many months before, because we tried to do some other things with the case, and it was available for a long, long time, and was discussed informally, so there was no lack of knowing what it said.
So if you asked her questions about the reliability of these tests, and the administrative law judge heard that these tests were reliable.
And as I recall, he asked a question or two when he didn't understand something. They sometimes do that in especially workers' comp cases.
Our problem here may be that he didn't make specific findings that the dynamic blind box test or the Peabody picture vocabulary test or the Bender visual motor Gestalt test were reliable. That may be the problem that we have here.
He made findings that as to Doris Shriver's expert qualifications, and she was admitted without objection, as Your Honor's already noted. The foundation that was required, in my understanding, had nothing to do with Schreck or all of that. It had to do with the foundation of a co-author of a document explaining what, to what extent she participated in creating that document, how the tests were chosen, how they were given, and the judge ruled that he felt, number one, that her expertise was such that it was, it would be helpful. Now, the document could have and probably should have been admitted initially under the statute, as I believe Your Honor brought up. But because this was a fairly young man, a 54-year-old man, as I recall at that time, I felt it was very important to have the expert's specific qualifications and her thoughts and the way she created the report to go into evidence so the judge could hear that. Oftentimes in workers' compensation cases, you're told, counsel, move along, very quickly. And this wasn't something I felt could be explained quickly. So I thought it was of help not to introduce it as a vocational report, which it certainly was, under the statute, which it could have been, but to allow it to wait and have that important foundation given so that all of her expertise and all of her participation in getting the result. If the report went in, the number of questions that could have been asked to explain why this man couldn't do any work, which is a really hard test for a 54-year-old man, I felt it was really important to get that foundation in and allowed it to happen. And maybe I made a mistake in doing that. But there's no question it could have been admitted either way, and that it is admissible, at least in my mind.
Counsel, do you agree with the ALJ's finding that this is not a scientific test?
I don't know whether medicine or occupational therapy or nursing are sciences, because I was a mathematician and physicist before I became a lawyer. I don't consider them scientific, because they're not hard science. Is an occupational therapist a scientist? I wouldn't think so. But
my question is: are the tests that the occupational therapist testified about scientific? Do they require some foundation in order to create their reliability?
Again, if you gave 100 people these tests, you wouldn't get a mathematical accuracy or a sameness. You would get tendencies. Because some people have a higher tolerance for pain, they'll lift more than other people who have a lower tolerance for pain, for example. So I think there's a degree of subjectivity to the in what an occupational therapist does, to the same extent that what a doctor does. When a doctor asks you questions and determines how long to spend with you and what medication to give you, those results aren't, in my mind, mathematically scientific. It's a judgment call of an expert. If every judgment call of an expert is scientific, then that's kind of a different definition than I would think. I think the Schreck test is for new, novel, untested, unusual types of tests. And these are standard tests that have been given for decades. So I wouldn't say so, but I don't know.
But that evidence of standard tests given for decades is not in the record.
She did testify that they were standard occupational therapy tests and how long she'd been an occupational therapist.
Counsel, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
The case will stand submitted and an opinion will issue in due course.